calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
The will of the people, wrote Thomas Jefferson, the only legitimate foundation of any government and to protect its free expression should be our first object. You're home for the free expression of the will of the people. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program, or welcome to our program on this beautiful Wednesday here, the 24th of May. Coming up on today's program, unembedded journalist in Iraq, Aaron Glantz, is reporting on how America lost Iraq. In the third hour of our program, Jeffrey Feldman will be dropping by with his, from frameshopisopen.com, with his new frame, Send in the Boardroom Patrol. So we'll be getting to all of that today as we continue. 971 days, 12 hours, 53 minutes, 41 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. That is, assuming that there's no impeachment between now and then. David Tebow is with us. He's the editor-in-chief at CNS News, Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com, the website, a conservative news website, I guess you would call it. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
David, the guest worker program that will...
You mean amnesty, don't you?
Say that again?
You mean amnesty, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, and this this amnesty slash guest worker program that, that the Bush administration, Republicans in Congress, and a lot of Democrats in Congress are promoting, is going to help break the unions. The more the labor force is diluted, the less power unions have. I'm wondering why you would oppose something that's going to be so harmful to unions.
Well, we don't. I don't think the conservatives see it as being harmful or really that beneficial to unions. We see it as a law and order issue. If you broke the law coming here to the United States, you don't deserve amnesty, plain and simple.
But the law of my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, and I may well be, I'm not a scholar of this stuff, but my understanding is that the laws in the United States that have to do with being here illegally are somewhat different than in most countries. In Mexico, for example, if you go to Mexico illegally, it's a felony. You go to jail for up to a year.
Right.
Here in the United States, in some municipalities, jaywalking, for example, Beverly Hills, jaywalking is a more serious crime than being here as an illegal immigrant. So,
it is a civil violation. You're right.
That's right. But so to say that, and keep in mind, I am totally opposed to granting amnesty to people who are here illegally, but at the same time, it's I don't get it how you can say this is a law and order issue when that's the particular law you want to enforce, and there are other laws that are much stronger that I don't hear a groundswell of calling for enforcement.
Like what?
Well, jaywalking, for example. If jaywalking is a bigger crime than being here illegally, and the reason your moral position, your moral stance on this is that these folks have broken the law, then why not have a crackdown on jaywalkers?
Well, jaywalking doesn't lead to burglaries and rapes and murders the way illegal immigration does. And nobody serious is going to tell you that jaywalking is the equivalent, much less a more serious offense.
Well, okay, so I think that what you've just done is highlighted your real concern, which is not so much that these folks are here have broken the law coming here. We agree on that. And we agree that people should not be allowed to be in the United States, or at least to work in the United States, or even to be in the United States without some sort of legal status in any country. I mean, this is what countries do. And yet, it sounds to me like, based on what you just said, David Tebow, that your main concern is that the folks coming here are robbers and rapists, and yet, if you look at the stats on illegal immigrants, you find that there's actually a fairly low level of crime among them. I mean, yes, a lot of them are showing up in our jails and our courts because there's 20 million of them here. I mean, that's a huge cohort. That's a huge chunk of the population.
Tom, are you aware that a quarter of federal prisoners are illegal immigrants?
I am, yeah.
Well, that's not a small percentage.
I don't disagree with you, but the problem there is that the reason why they're in the federal prisons is because of their illegal alien status, not because of the crimes that they've committed, not because they were bank robbers who go to federal prison as opposed to a murderer who would go to a state
prison. Actually, they're in federal prison because they committed a more grievous offense while they were here illegally, or they would not be in federal prison because the system currently, as you've described, only provides for civil prosecutions and not criminal prosecutions.
Right. So, but at the federal level, if you have committed a crime in the United States and an individual state can't prosecute you for that, you end up in the federal system.
And you get deported, unless you have committed a more grievous offense. And in the case of the one quarter of the federal prisoners who are illegal immigrants, they have committed more grievous offenses. So it's not a small percentage that come here illegally and then commit crimes. It's a big percentage that come here illegally and commit crimes. So
what's,
we've got
what's
to be
the number,
aware of the consequences.
What's the and you know, it's interesting, David, because I suspect that you and I are on the same side of this argument, but for different reasons. What could, because it sounds to me like, you know, your concern is, oh my God, these people are coming here committing crimes, and maybe there's even an association with because they're brown people after all, or something like that.
No, of course not. That's
okay.
Ridiculous.
I had to toss it out, give you a chance to clean it up.
Well, I was a cheap shot, and it was,
and you know, yeah. And so, how many people are in federal prisons who are illegal aliens? What's the raw number?
Approximately, I think it's 26%. Of the inmates in federal prisons.
What's the number?
I don't have a number at my disposal right now. I could look it up.
I mean, it might be 5,000 people. It might be 50,000 people. I don't know how many people are in federal prisons.
And I can't give you that exact figure. I know that it's approximately 26% because of some past reporting that we have done.
Right, but we only have a fairly limited federal prison system.
No,
most crimes are violations of state law.
You're talking about tens and tens of thousands of prisoners.
More than 10,000 people.
No, you're talking about a lot of individuals.
Let's say it's 100,000 people.
Okay.
I doubt that either one of us thinks it's actually that many people. Pardon?
If you're talking about 100,000 people, 26% of that is 26,000 people.
So 26,000 out of 20 million is a smaller percentage. Smaller percentage of illegal immigrants.
If we didn't let any of those 26,000 people here illegally, then there wouldn't be any of those crimes committed by those 26,000 people. How about that?
No, I'll give you that. I'll give you that. Here's my concern about this, my issue with all of this, and that is that there has been an unremitting assault on the middle class ever since Ronald Reagan came into office, and that assault has taken two forms, primarily on the wages of the middle class. The first is Ronald Reagan declaring war on unions and trying to roll back the reforms of the New Deal. And then
you have an interesting view of history.
Well, I think I can back it up. And, you know, busting PATCO and then the ongoing process.
PATCO made an illegal strike.
When Ronald Reagan came into office, 25% of the American workforce was unionized. The private workforce right now is about 8% unionized.
That's because of our capitalist system, which
capitalist system had taken us from pretty much 0% unionized to 35% unionized just before Reagan.
Socialism did that. Capitalism, by its nature, discourages unionism because it rewards incentive.
Capitalism, by its nature, that is discouraging unionism, is anti-democratic. A corporation is the last vestige of a kingdom.
It's pro-incentive. It's pro-ingenuity.
It is anti-democratic.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
And it is anti-democratic.
Well, if you want to
the only democratic institution,
on the Democratic Party to provide unions, you can have it.
The only democratic institution that we have in the workplace is the union.
It's socialist.
It is democracy.
It's dumbed down. It discourages incentive.
I reject those arguments, number one. And secondly, I would say unions are the only place where you have democracy in the world. But the point I was trying to make, David, where I'm trying to agree with you,
is that
hordes of illegal aliens, you know, to use historical language, are diluting the labor force and making it easier to bust unions and driving down wages. I would suggest that they're one of the main reasons why we haven't seen an increase in the minimum wage in 15 years. I don't understand why guys on your side aren't saying, isn't that wonderful?
Well, we don't care about that aspect. I mean, if they're driving down wages and hurting union employees, well, then the unions need to work it out. But we're not going to help them work anything out because unions are so against capitalism and so.
But by opposing illegal immigration, you're helping the unions.
Well, however the unions decide that they have to handle that aspect, you know, that's for them to handle it. We see it as a law and order issue in which anybody who's here illegally doesn't belong here, period. I mean, it's that simple.
As I said, I'm not disagreeing with you. But there are so many conservatives who are into this issue because they want to serve the corporate masters. They want the corporations to show higher profits. Why not you? David?
We need to argue about unions on another day, Tom.
Yeah, I guess we do. David Tebow, the editor. In fact, stick around for a minute, David. Let's continue this conversation, if you can. Can you?
Just for one more segment.
You got it.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we, the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, on June 12th through the 14th, the Take Back America 2006 Campaign for America's Future is putting on this conference, the Take Back America 2006 conference. I will be broadcasting live from the conference on Monday and Tuesday of that week. The website is ourfuture.org, the Campaign for America's Future, and check it out. 21 minutes past the hour. David Tebow has dropped out. Off he went. He had other things to do. Greg in Houston, Texas. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Hey, David was just ticking me off. If it wasn't for the unions here in Texas, I wouldn't have a job. I wouldn't have a training. I wouldn't have a skill. I started at the bottom as a helper in sheet metal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I worked my way up. Became an apprentice, went through 4 years of school, learning a trade.
Right.
I am a journeyman now. I make a decent wage. I don't make the wages like we used to before Reagan. When Reagan came into office, all our wages went down the tube.
And have ever since fairly steadily.
Our wages went up. Now they're steadily declining because we have to fight for jobs because other non-union non-union shops in Texas, because Texas is an open right-to-work state, hire the illegal aliens and drop their prices.
Right. Well, it's actually a combination of two things. It's number one, you have illegal aliens who are diluting the labor force domestically for those jobs that can't be exported. And then at the same time, you have conservative economic policies exporting jobs. So, you know, you've got, you know, manufacturing facilities going to China and India and, well, pretty much everywhere, Mexico and every place else. And those jobs that can't be exported, they're bringing in labor to do the jobs. And it's just
that is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah. It's a mess.
Here in Houston, immigration comes around to the job sites, rounds them up. A couple days later, they're back on the job. It's catch and release.
Yeah.
Why can't the United States government enforce the laws that are already on the books that says it is illegal to hire an undocumented worker and ship them back where they go, where they came from?
Well, it's a really good question, and I think you'll find the answer in the list of campaign contributors to most of our politicians.
Right, but, I mean, even the Democratic Party is wanting to create amnesty.
Yeah, I said politicians, not Republicans.
I'm blaming everyone in Washington. I'm not picking on one party or the other.
Yep.
Everyone in Washington does not understand we already have laws on the books. Enforce the laws.
Well said. I'm right there with you, Greg. Thank you a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Jason.
Yes. Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Thanks for taking my call. First of all, just two quick comments. As far as the benefit of unions, everybody has a different opinion, but the main component that unions bring to the workplace is the fact that employers aren't able to just fire employees indiscriminately, which if there were no unions, if you buck the boss, if you speak your mind, if you have any kind of a minor error or problem, you can be fired without a union.
Sure.
Unions oversee that those sort of issues. The second issue is immigration. If the laws were enforced, we wouldn't even have to ship these illegal immigrants back. They would go back on their own, because if they cannot find a job, if they cannot be employed, their only option is to go home.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Jason. And in fact, apropos to that point, the Center for Immigration Studies, CIS.org, I believe is their website, has a paper. It's called Attrition Through Enforcement by Jessica Vaughn, Cost-Effective Strategy to Shrink the Illegal Population. And she points out that trying to deport illegal aliens is not, you know, I mean, it's silly. And the folks in Congress, Republicans, Democrats, right across the board, they're all setting this thing up as if it's either give amnesty to everybody who's here, on the one hand, or, on the other hand, get out the Gestapo, start rounding people up, putting them in buses and railroad cars, and haul them off. And those two extreme options are equally ridiculous, in my opinion, equally destructive. And what she suggests is what's called an attrition through enforcement strategy. And she says a strategy of attrition, in other words, enforcing the law, making it so that people can't get jobs. She says a strategy of attrition through enforcement could reduce the illegal population by as many as 1.5 million illegal aliens each year. Currently, about 183,000 illegals depart the country without intervention. She points out, for example, after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security went after Pakistanis who were in the country illegally in a couple of big cities. They removed 1,500 illegal Pakistani residents. As a consequence of that, 15,000 illegal Pakistani immigrants left the country on their own. They said, "Hey, this is a hostile environment. It's not a friendly place to be any longer." The bottom line was, we can't get a job. These are people who had been employed. That's how they got tracked down, was through their employment. She says requiring employers to verify the status of workers could deny jobs to about 3 million illegal workers immediately, affecting one-third of the illegal population. And interestingly enough, the Senate just voted, and this is fascinating how this vote broke out, which parties, to penalize $20,000 to a fine for an employer for hiring an unauthorized worker. But there's a catch. I'll tell you about that right after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman. And it's gone. The birds when they don't want to sing. Gone people, how awkward would that thing
be? Tom Hartman here with you. Well, here's the, by the way, before I continue, I just wanted to say, since we're talking about unions here, I got a birthday gift. And I don't want to encourage people to send me things, so I didn't want to talk about it. But on the other hand, this is like something that's just like really cool. I've been complaining for some time that nobody makes blue jeans in the United States anymore. Levi Strauss closed their last U.S. factory last year. We memorialized that on this program. Maybe it was a year and a half ago, thereabouts. And so Mike and Denise Kitchen, who run a website called the Waking Up Store, stylish attire for you and your world, wakingupstore.com, their website, sent me a letter. Tom, I've been listening to your show since it was on a UAW-owned station here in Detroit. That would have been 3 years ago when we were on the IE America radio network, which the United Auto Workers owned. They closed it down when Air America came along, and Mike Malloy and I and Peter Werby and Nancy Skinner, a bunch of us were, and Peter B. Collins, a bunch of us were on IE America radio, and have now made the transition to various other places. And this program now syndicated by Air America. Anyhow, he says, on November 19, 2005, my wife and I opened up our store, Waking Up Store. It is a sweatshop-free, socially and environmentally responsible clothing store in the Universal Mall in Warren, Michigan. and Sweatshop Free is our baseline. We carry U.S.-made, union-made clothing made of standard cotton and denim. We also carry eco-fabrics such as organic cotton and hemp. As many as you know, hemp is illegal to grow in the United States, so many of our clothes are manufactured overseas, but by companies that have earned the Co-op America seal of approval as being sweatshop-free green businesses. And so they sent me a pair of jeans for my birthday, and I've been wearing them for, about a month now. And they're the most comfortable jeans, I've got to say, that, you know, they're comfortable to walk in and comfortable to sit in. And typically, jeans are comfortable for one or the other, but not both. These are great. So thank you, Mike and Denise. I appreciate it. And if folks want to check out their store, it's wakingupstore.com. So back to illegal immigrants. This is the kind of mind-boggling, well, not kind of, the mind-boggling story end of this thing. The Senate voted Tuesday to fine employers. This is the Associated Press story. To fine employers who hire illegal immigrants up to $20,000 for each unauthorized worker, providing teeth to a broad immigration bill before sending it to a final vote later this week. Now, this is really interesting. Here is the Senate voting to say, okay, if you hire an illegal immigrant, or an illegal alien, rather, you will be hit with a $20,000 fine. And what's really interesting is to see who voted for and against this, because it was almost exclusively Democrats voting for it, and mostly Republicans voting against it. The only Democrats who voted against this were Dorgan of North Dakota and Nelson of Nebraska. They're the only ones who voted no on the $20,000 fine for hiring illegal aliens. And a bunch of Republicans, and so all the other yes votes, there were 58 yes votes, all the rest of them were all the Democrats in the Senate, with the exception of Dorgan and Nelson, and Rockefeller, who did not vote on this particular vote. But then they were joined by a handful of Republicans, Chafee, Collins, Graham, Grassley, Gregg, Hagel, Lugar, McCain, Snow, Specter, Stevens, and Warner. Those were the Republicans who crossed over. So you have Democrats and a handful of Republicans who are saying, let's deal with the real problem here, which is the employers, which is the hiring. Now, here's, however, the kicker on this thing. First of all, they're going to set it up so that it's going to work the same way that AMC Theaters is doing right now as we speak, where they simply confirm the Social Security number with the Social Security Administration. Is this a person, a real, are they really here? Is this really the person? Is this person in front of me really the person they say they are? Because 95, 98, 99% of them, you just blow them right out because they're using phony Social Security numbers or non-existent Social Security numbers. So you've got that as a starting point. But here's the, when I saw that this bill was passed, I was like, wow, $20,000 fine for each unauthorized worker. This is, somebody's really doing something about this. And wow, it's the Democrats who are voting to do it. I'm really impressed. And then I read a little more carefully. Employers would have to check Social Security numbers and the immigration status of all new hires. New hires. The House bill would require employers to screen all employees instead of only new hires. So there's the gotcha. This is only going to apply to new hires. And even at that, virtually every Republican in the United States Senate voted against this, which is revealing the real issue here. The real issue is all about cheap labor. This is just pure and simple, all about cheap labor. There's no other way to describe it. That's the bottom line. Mike Pence, Representative Mike Pence, Republican from Indiana, who heads a group of 100 conservatives in the House of Representatives, said Tuesday he plans to offer a bill this week that would let employers rehire illegal workers now on their payrolls after they've returned home and applied for a new W visa. Is this a bit of irony? I mean, it's got to be, right? Apply for a W visa. Is it George W. Bush? Workers. You think that's what it is, David? It's a, yeah, I'm sure it is, but it's still, it's just a, it, be incredible. The administration failed. This from Reuters. President George W. Bush's plan to send thousands of National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border could spark a surge in immigration cases. Now, here's another, the law of unintended consequences, or of just, you know, moronic screw-ups on the part of the Bush administration. There, if they send all these National Guard troops down there, and if they start busting people coming across the border illegally, well, you're going to have fewer people working in the workplace, but now you're going to have zillions of people in the courts being prosecuted. And Bush asked, in fact, the administration failed to plan, this from Richard Collins' article in Reuters, the administration failed to plan for the surge in court cases and did not consult the judicial branch of government on the impact more arrests would have on federal courts in the region, said Dick Corelli, a spokesman for the U.S. federal courts. Bush asked for $1.9 million in emergency funds for the border plan, including $20 million to help the Justice Department deal with its increased caseload, but that did not include the courts. So, anyhow, that topic kind of done to death, as it were, but it's going to continue. But the important thing to keep in mind is this is not just about illegal immigration. This is really about the exporting of our jobs and the importing of workers. This is really about cheap labor. This is really the corporate agenda. That's the bottom line. And it saddens me to see Democrats going along with this. And of course, you expect Republicans to. You expect Republicans to be in favor of these so-called free trade agreements, NAFTA and CAFTA and all this kind of thing. You don't expect this from Democrats. And so many of them are. And progressives in particular. It's just and even labor unions. It just saddens me. On this day in history, May 24th, 1964, Senator Barry Goldwater, running for the Republican Party nomination in the upcoming presidential election, gave an interview in which he suggested the use, or he actually just discussed the use, of low-yield atomic bombs in North Vietnam. Yeah, not a good plan, Barry, and thus got beat pretty badly by Lyndon Johnson, that among other things, which led to Goldwater's famous speech at the Republican National Convention, his nominating convention, where he said,
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
And you could argue that he has a point there. I mean, that was the position that Washington, Jefferson, and Madison took.
And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
And, you know, I think he has a point there, too. It's just that it all went too far, tragically. So, anyway, we'll see how this thing breaks out. We are in a time of war. Right? It's a time of war. Well, it's a time of conflict. Anyway, it's very much a time of conflict.
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going?
There you go. And so, looking at what's going on in Iraq, near Tharathar Lake, U.S. forces killed four insurgents and detained two others on Tuesday. U.S. in Yusufaya, U.S. forces killed three al-Qaeda-linked insurgents, they say. Near Swaara, clashes that erupted on Tuesday between two tribes killed 16 people and wounded 18. And the trial of Saddam Hussein continues. So the news from Iraq. And, of course, yesterday, Pat Robertson came out and said that he was able to leg press 2,000 pounds because of his age-defying protein shake. The guy who holds the world record, which was 665 pounds under 2,000, about 1,400 pounds, his eyes burst. The capillaries in his eyes burst. So Pat Robertson now holds the world's record, and his eyes are working. We'll be right back, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
DUI, I made bail. Daddy sent me off to Yale.
With a nickname for my rent, all your money spent.
I'm a wartime president.
He's a wartime president.
Just ignore those body bags.
With a knick-knack bomberang, all your money's spent.
I'm a wartime president.
He's a wartime president.
Knick-knack bomberang.
I'm in charge. I'm the pres. I do just what Cheney says.
With a knick-knack bomberang, all your money's spent.
And welcome back, my friends. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Angry lawmakers demand FBI return seized documents. I want to get into this in some depth in the second hour of our program here. What's going on with why are the Republicans in Congress concerned that a Democrat got busted? Mr. Jefferson, the Democrat from New Orleans, got busted for taking a $100,000 bribe, $90,000 of it found as cold cash in his refrigerator. But there's a larger issue here as well, in my opinion, and that is, why is the FBI conducting sting operations like this against Democrats? Are Democrats being singled out, number one? And number two, should the government break the law in order to find lawbreakers? And this is a topic that we haven't talked about in the United States since the early 90s. It was 1992, the last time the Supreme Court took this case up. And in that case, the Supreme Court actually ruled that the government can't break the law in order to find lawbreakers. So I want to get into that in a little more detail a little bit later on. Right now, Patricia from Sacramento, California, in the line, our number 866-440-8466. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. In regards to unions, I think Mr. Tebow, it's interesting how he categorizes them as socialist organizations, because let's remember the history of unions. They brought us the 8 hours day, maximum 40 hours per week. Overtime.
That's socialism.
Yes, lunch breaks. God forbid
socialism.
If you pay people decent, you know, wages.
Oh, decent wages, that's socialism.
Oh, absolutely. And then you have the age of industrialization, Tom. You know this better than I do. You're a great historian, where you had dangerous conditions, you had child labor, you had forced labor. I mean, these were conditions that were under private corporations. And that's what happens when you have a system where you don't have unions, where you don't have the will of the working class that have a say in their workplace. And also, you know what I wanted to remind him was interesting was the mining industries. This is a perfect example. If the mining industry were unionized, I'm not saying they'd be at 100% perfect, but this is some of the problems we're having in the United States with these mining companies.
Well, and in fact, the mining industry in Canada is 100% unionized, and 100% of all mines have safe rooms. They build these rooms where if there's an explosion, they build them as they're moving down the mine, they keep moving them along, and if there's an explosion, the miners have these respirator packs that are good for about an hour, just like ours do here, although ours don't always work. And then once they get to that room, they can sit in that room for several days while they're awaiting rescue. So we had a situation just, you know, a month or so ago in Canada where there was a mine explosion and some miners got trapped in a mine and they were there for 2 days and they got brought out safely because they had a safe room to go to where they had food, water, and oxygen. And we don't do that in the United States. Why? Because it would reduce corporate profits by maybe 0.1%. It might cut down a little bit the amount of money that the CEO would have to be paid or the dividends to the stockholders. And so instead we have dead miners in the United States.
Absolutely, Tom. One last thing I want to leave you with is next time you should ask Mr. Tebow, would he prefer that our airplane mechanics, our air traffic control, our pilots, people that build our bridges, be run by private corporations of cheap labor? I wonder how safe he would feel.
Well, I suspect, I can't speak for David Tebow, but I can tell you that the conservative talking point or the conservative response to that, these from people who are believers in the so-called free market, is that, well, if you've got a company that's producing shoddy bridges, then they will be replaced by a company that produces good bridges because there'll be demand for it and good air traffic controllers and good, you know, quack, quack, quack. And the problem is that it doesn't account for the precautionary principle at all. Basically what it says is we don't fix something until a horrible crime has been committed, until we know that it's broken and people die as a consequence of that. And it's
yeah, but you have to pay for quality employees. That's the thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't pay somebody $5 an hour and say, here, you can be an airplane mechanic and you're going to get quality work.
Yeah,
just the nature.
Except that the airlines are doing that right now. It's really quite remarkable. About half of all the airline maintenance that is done right now on U.S. airlines is not done in the United States. It's being done down in Central America where they literally are paying mechanics $5 an hour.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. Patricia, thanks a lot for the call. Good talking to you. David in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hey, David.
Hi. I have two issues with getting rid of illegal workers. And the first one is that there have been illegal workers in this country during the entire history of the country, and the problem for illegal workers didn't start until Reagan started shipping jobs overseas and breaking unions. So illegal workers themselves aren't the actual problem. The second issue I have is...
That's what I've been saying all along. It's the employers that are the problem.
Right. The second issue is that as long as we're going to these people's countries and stealing their wealth and bringing it here, I don't think we have the right to tell them they can't come here and participate in the wealth that we've stolen from them.
Well, I just respectfully, I agree with you that our foreign policy and our trade policies are corrupt and predatory. And I don't think that just because our nation is participating in those, therefore there's any therefore attached to that. I think we need to say, hey, the WTO, NAFTA, all these things, these are corrupt, and certainly our agricultural supports, these are corrupt and predatory practices, and we have to stop them because they're the wrong thing to do. Not we have to stop them because only then can we say, no, we can't have illegal immigration. I think when you start tying those two things together, you're going down a road that is not a road that any of us want to go down.
Except that what are the people going to do if their wealth is here and they can't come here and take some of it?
Well, the fact of the matter is, David, that about half of the population of Mexico is living on less than $2 a day 50 years ago when there were 20 million people in Mexico. And about a half of Mexico's population right now is living on $2 a day with 110 million people in Mexico. So, I mean, they've always had poverty in Mexico. It's not purely and simply a consequence of our policies. A large chunk of it has to do with how corrupt the oligarchy is there. And there's some real serious problems. And we're providing Vicente Fox with a safety valve. I mean, they're fixing to elect a right-wing president now because we're providing a safety valve to their economy and for their political distance. Come here. It's not good for Mexico. Next, how we lost Iraq with guest Aaron Glantz right after this.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour. 971 days, 11 hours, 54 minutes, 21 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, assuming no impeachment. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com. And be sure you get the is open in there. FrameShopIsOpen.com. Jeffrey Feldman, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Jeffrey. You, right up at the very top of FrameShop is Open here today, Bush framing Latinos with words from terror speeches.
It's really incredible. But I'm still following this story about this immigration debate that's going on. There's a bill that is slowly creeping towards being passed in the Senate. And what I did this morning is I noticed in one of the speeches that that the vice president had given just recently to a military audience, he used this phrase about terrorism being in the shadows. And it's a phrase that I thought went back all the way to the time right after we were attacked.
On
9/11, exactly. But I also noticed that notion of something being in the shadows had emerged in the immigration speech that the president gave on television last week. So I went to the White House website, and it's a great resource. They've got a search button there, and I put in the word shadows, and sure enough, the concept of terrorism being in the shadows began being used by the administration back in 2001, right after, the day after 9/11. And then suddenly, last week, that phrase, in the shadows, was plucked out of the speeches on terrorism and used in the speeches on immigration. And the way that it worked was, whereas the president had talked about terrorists being a new kind of enemy lurking in the shadows, we had to root them out and find them, this was being used in order to cultivate this atmosphere of total fear to justify various ways that the administration violated the Constitution. And suddenly it was being used to describe the condition of immigrants in this country. And when the administration is talking about immigrants, they're talking about Latinos. So it was very, very curious to find this language appearing in an attempt, it seems, to frame the discussion on immigration so that the Latinos become this opportunity to once again cultivate fear and save their dwindling political fortunes.
Well, and there's a larger issue around that frame as well. When Bush applies these kinds of frames to particular groups, whether it's Muslims or whether it's Latinos, he's also ramping up the terror among the rest of among other Americans who aren't part of one of those two groups.
Exactly. I mean, that's exactly the argument that I made in the piece this morning, was that what he's doing is he's giving a green light to these vigilante groups to essentially believe that their type of behavior, you know, running to the border with hunting rifles and taking matters into their own hands. When the president frames the discussion on immigration using the same language that he put in his speeches on terrorism, he is giving the okay to these groups to take matters into their own hands. So it's a very dangerous approach that he's taking, and it's no surprise that Latinos in America are very, very concerned at these developments.
But it's dangerous to him politically as well, because he has his own party now, and his position is that these folks should be decriminalized, that they should be given amnesty, that they should, you know, be given an opportunity to continue holding down low-wage jobs, to keep wages down so that corporations can have increased profits. And so there's a major talking out of both sides of your mouth problem here. Is this because on the one hand he wants to say a few words that'll pacify his base, and on the other hand, you know, he has to do what the corporations want and be sure that they have a steady supply of cheap or slave labor? Or is this because there's some inherent schizophrenia inside this administration?
I think there is some schizophrenia. One of the things that is a question in my mind is, you know, if I could be at those tables listening to those conversations, what I would like to know is exactly what the minimum level of gains the president is trying to get out of these speeches on immigration, because it seems that they're having these sessions where they're saying, look, we're in serious trouble. We've got to go after some group in order to appease our hardcore base. And my sense is that by repeating this concept, and Cheney is just repeating this word, these phrases about being in the shadows over and over again, I think that they're really appeasing to this hardline right nationalist voice in the Republican Party in these border states where people are just very, very angry.
Well, it's not just the border states. I mean, New York City, Chicago, Atlanta, these are, you know, Nebraska now with all the meatpacking plants. These are major destinations for illegal immigrants.
Exactly.
So I wonder also to what extent what we may be seeing here is the projection, you know, not to get too Freudian and Jungian on this whole thing, but you know, there is, I think, something to be said for the idea that George W. Bush in particular sees in other people those aspects of himself that he's unwilling to confront in his life, whether it's his alcoholism or his anger, his rage at his family, his feelings of abandonment. You know, he was raised by prep schools and nannies and things, all that kind of stuff. To what extent he may be, and that Cheney may be, you know, kind of helping drive it along just as a nice, useful political thing, he may be projecting his own fear. I mean, he was, look at 9/11. He was clearly terrified. I mean, and on Air Force One, hopscotching from city to city without any rhyme or reason, apparently afraid that somebody was going to take a shot at him. And I get the sense that there's a lot of fear inside George W. Bush, and maybe that's just coming out.
I think that's a great point. I mean, one of the things that's so alarming about that, though, is that it's understandable on some level to think about the president being, you know, afraid as an individual after the country had just been attacked by a certain number of planes and there are a lot of deaths. And
one was heading for the White House, as far as everybody knows.
Exactly. But then, and so to appeal, you know, to project his fears, to use that term, and to appear to what is a very kind of core, almost archetypal notion of childhood fear, this notion of something lurching in the shadows, in that moment, for, you know, in 2001, on some level, that makes sense. But now to use the same strategy because one has political fear, that just seems extremely wrong to me. That it does speak to the idea that the president is very much backed into a corner and that he's reverting to some type of very primal, very base level political strategy.
Well, he got about a 5 or 6 point bounce out of that immigrant speech. I mean, some Americans think, well, finally he's doing something. Okay, that's good. But, no, my point was that maybe this is not intentional. Maybe this is not focus grouped. Maybe this is not Frank Luntz at work. Maybe what you're seeing is the actual unconscious processes of George W. Bush leaking out, that his this is a guy who I suspect lives in terror all the time.
Huh.
And I think he has his entire life. I think he has since he was 7 years old, and his little sister died, or his older sister, I guess it was. No, his younger sister died, and his family went golfing the next day, his mother and father, and they never discussed it. It was just never discussed with him. And Justin Frank writes about this at some length in his book Bush on the Couch, that he has lived in fear of death and of you know, the uncertainties of life in a big way, in an unresolved way. You know, it's a deep, profound neurosis. Or maybe I'm just, you know, it's so easy to devolve into psychobabble. And, you know,
it's a fascinating point, though. And the president, by virtue of how staged he is typically in public and how little we get insights into the actual person, it leaves him wide open to this type of speculation. It's an interesting idea.
The other frame that you mentioned, Jeffrey Feldman, over at frameshopisopen.com, send in the boardroom patrol.
Yeah, it's a turn of phrase. And all this talk about border patrol, you know, the big issue in terms of progressive reframing of the immigration issue, which is several issues, that we shouldn't, you know, just be talking about border safety. It's important to guard the gates and to guard the entrances into our country. But we need to be talking about boardroom problems and what's going on in corporations. And so I came up with this way of turning the discussion around by calling for the boardroom patrol. Send in the patrol to these corporate entities who are violating the fair labor laws in this country and creating this flow of illegal workers that's not being talked about.
It's interesting. I had the executive director of the Minutemen on this program earlier in the week, and I was expecting some foam-at-the-mouth, right-wing, WASP guy, and instead I get a reasonable guy who's Hispanic, you know, and he said that they've saved the lives of thousands of people along the border, that they've brought in tens of thousands of gallons of water, that they don't carry weapons, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that really shocked me was he said they've been picketing, they've been protesting outside companies that employ illegal aliens, and nobody will cover it. The media won't cover it.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, the media has just completely dropped the ball on.
I mean, there is a boardroom patrol. These guys, you know, the Minutemen are actually doing this. And I'm very ambivalent about these guys because I think they're drawing the most freaked out racist xenophobes in our society into their group. You know, it's like honey for flies. But when they're doing something like this, going after companies, it gets ignored.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it all shakes out. It's interesting times we live in. Today, or yesterday, I guess it was, the Senate voted a $20,000 fine to employers who hire illegal immigrants, but it only applies to new hires.
Only applies to new hires, and it's couched in this language about this new technology that they need to adapt, which is very, very sketchy.
Yeah, very sketchy. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, the website. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. The website, smalldog.com, of course. Victoria Jones with us from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., an accredited White House reporter. Victoria.
Yes, indeed, Tom. Thank you very much. Accredited White House reporter, despite the fact that I don't think they like me very much. But they let me in anyway.
They let you in anyway.
Yes.
And a fine thing it is, because you get to ask some really tough questions. So what's going on in Washington, D.C. these days?
Well, a couple of things. One thing that I'm finding quite fascinating is the theft of these discs from this mid-level analyst's home, the man who worked at the Veterans Administration.
Mm-hmm.
he had taken them home to work on them, which is against policy, and then we heard on Monday that there had been a burglary at his home and they'd been stolen. And now it turns out that, yes, that had happened, but it had happened nearly 3 weeks ago, and that veterans had decided to handle this internally, hadn't reported it to the FBI, and certainly hadn't told the public, even though 1 in 10 Americans is impacted by this, because there's 1 in 10 Americans whose data is on this disk. And the only reason that they've come forward now, it seems, is because somebody was about to leak it. The FBI is furious, saying, reasonably it seems to me, that any clues or leads that there might have been have gone.
Yeah. Yeah, they should have been investigating this before it was in the newspapers. This was the thing. This is the question that I asked. I had Larry Scott on from VAWatchdog.org. This was back when we thought that it had happened the day of the news release. And I said, Larry, if somebody just stole a computer and there's, you know, millions of pieces of information on it, why are we using the newspapers to inform them that they're sitting on something that's worth a whole lot more than just a computer when they take it down to the local pawn shop?
Exactly. I've actually heard news reports saying, well, these thieves may not know what they've got, and I'm shouting at the TV, well, they do now!
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Quite extraordinary.
It really is. It's just the once again, the bumbling incompetence of the Bush administration. You know, these guys couldn't find, well, yeah, don't get me started. Anyhow, it's okay.
So continuing with different aspects of the Bush administration, two more things. Of course, we've got the FCC saying that it can't investigate the NSA because it hasn't got access to classified documents.
Now, this is after the Justice Department just said that they can't investigate it either.
Right, they can't investigate because they can't get security clearances.
That's what the VA should have done. They should have said the information was classified, and therefore the FBI can't investigate it, because if the FBI is forbidden from investigating whether the Bush administration broke any laws with regard to NSA spying, because it's classified, the VA could have done the same thing, which raises the question, why didn't Congressman Jefferson simply say that the FBI can't arrest him, can't have information, because it's classified? After all, it worked for George W. Bush.
He wasn't quick enough or smart enough to think of it.
Yeah, yeah, both. He wasn't.
Both.
He was not either.
Exactly.
He was neither.
Exactly,
yes.
Right. So we've got that going on, and then of course we do have Congressman William Jefferson going on, or rather he's not the one who's going on. We have Denny Hastert going on, John Boehner going on, and Bill Frist going on. The three leaders of Congress, all Republicans, all up in arms about the FBI search of Congressman Jefferson, Democrats' office over the weekend, saying it's a violation of the separation of powers, and saying that they will take this to the Supreme Court. Some people are saying, well, you know, one of the reasons they're up in arms is that they don't want their own offices searched.
Well, of course they don't. And I would say to them, hey, guys, neither do we. Where were you during the Patriot Act discussions? I mean,
well,
they set it up so that we can be searched, but now they're all huffy puffy and full of righteous indignation at the possibility that they could be searched?
Well, that's different from us.
Yeah, well, they clearly think they are. I mean, it's like hypocrisy raised to an art form. Although there is a legitimate, I think that there is a legitimate constitutional issue here about separation of powers, and it's an important one and one that shouldn't be missed. And the Republicans are raising it. The Democrats, I think, would be raising it if they were in power or if it had been a Republican and been busted. Democrats just don't want to even have the appearance of standing up for William Jefferson.
No, they're staying far away from this. They can't.
Yeah, but it is a legitimate issue. On the other hand, the Fourth Amendment is a legitimate issue, and they, for all practical purposes, abrogated it by passing the Patriot Act, and so a pox on all their houses. I'm just, you know, it's, I think a lot of Americans are getting, you know, it's time to throw the bums out and replace them with some new folks. We need to get some good progressives into office all across this country. And there's a few decent progressive Republicans. Most of them are Democrats and other parties.
And polls are certainly showing that people want to throw them out. They're sick of Republicans, but they're more sick of incumbents.
You think that incumbent Democrats are as at risk as incumbent Republicans?
I don't believe they're as at risk, but I do believe they're at risk.
Yeah, significantly at risk. Interesting. So, yeah, well, November's going to bring a lot of surprises.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Has there been any coverage in the mainstream media about the thousands of voting machine problems that showed up during the primaries over the last few weeks?
Well, very little. These stories tend to show up on about page 19.
Yeah.
You know, of the kind of newspaper that has very few pictures and lots of small print.
And nobody is framing them in the context of the privatization of our vote.
No. No, not at all. It's almost as though the story is reported as though to say we're making a fuss if we complain.
Yeah, yeah, it's a shame. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Always wonderful talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, it's a frat boy alert.
George Bush could do no wrong. A war during Vietnam. Yeah, better ways to spend his time. Like getting drunk and doing lines. George Bush, the corporate whore, he's gonna wage perpetual war. The fight's here with a padded shawl. King George says, bring them on.
Look out for that frat boy. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Late Teamster leader Jimmy Hoffa appeared in a new video broadcast worldwide today in which he taunted the Bush administration for failing to find him in their recent search for his remains. For the Bush administration and the FBI, whose credibility as the nation's top crime investigating unit has been somewhat tarnished in recent years, the surprising appearance of the Hoffa video is just the latest in a series of setbacks. Looking surprisingly vigorous for a man who has not been heard from in over 30 years, Mr. Hoffa twitted the FBI agents for failing to locate him in Milford Township, about 30 miles north of Detroit. He said, "You can dig all you want, but you're never going to find Jimmy Hoffa. I'm going to Disneyland." At the Federal Bureau of Investigation, officials said they were studying the video closely, but early analysis indicated it was authentic. Mr. Hoffa's taunts created a public relations nightmare of sorts for the FBI, who immediately attempted to put the best spin on the video. FBI spokesperson Hendrick Bucknell said, "It does appear that Jimmy Hoffa has eluded our attempts to find him. On the positive side, this means we can stop digging." Mr. Bucknell said that the Hoffa video serves as a strong argument for the FBI's program of domestic surveillance. He said, in addition to eavesdropping on every living person in this country, we're now going to start doing it on dead ones, too. Elsewhere, in Montenegro voted to gain its independence from Serbia, thus creating a new country for President Bush to mispronounce. That from Andy Borowitz today, the Borowitz Report, borowitzreport.com. All the news you never knew was the news, tongue-in-cheek, of course, but interesting. And time now.
Just a push of a button, just a touch of a screen.
Yes. Hey, hackers, you who have some computer proficiency, do you know how to hack into an operating system, a Windows operating system? Well, actually, if you just even know how to hack around a Windows operating system, this may be the job for you. You, too, can help steal elections and make money at the same time. Well, that's not exactly how the headline reads. The headline reads, U.S. California San Francisco warehouse workers needed for shift. It's a job offering from Kelly Services. Kelly Services, Inc., a Fortune 500 company that excels in finding individuals just like yourself, opportunities to both begin and enhance their careers. The ad says, and I quote, "Kelly Services is currently looking for individuals with shipping and receiving warehouse background to work in San Francisco!" Exclamation mark. "We are looking for hardworking, responsible, punctual people to assist in dropping off election voting machines and picking these machines up when the voting is complete. Must be able to lift these electronic machines, approximately 40 pounds with little assistance. Access to private transportation is highly recommended, as is not easily accessible by public transportation. Pay $11.99 an hour. Your vote will be in the hands of somebody being paid $12 an hour, hired through a temp service, who may be carrying your voting machine on the bus. This is mind-boggling. It's what happens when you privatize things. I mean, the Bushies, the Republicans, have presided over the privatization of our voting. And so, gee, we shouldn't be surprised. Shouldn't be surprised at all. Line 3, I see, is ringing. We're going to check this out here. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Thomas.
Hey, how are you? I'm great. What's up?
Hey, by the way, I'm rich with you. It's not cheap labor. It's slave labor.
You're talking about illegal immigrants?
Oh, heck yeah. But you know what? By the way, I respect you tremendously. And you ever hear of the Molly Maguires? You were talking about unions?
You're talking about the late 19th century?
No, early 19th, 20th, actually. No, you're right. They were an Irish mining union started here in Pennsylvania.
Like in the 1880s, 1890s.
Wasn't right, it? And then...
It was around the time of the Wobblies.
Yes, and Tom, then there was, you ever hear of a town called Matewan in West Virginia? Same thing, miners again, and Homestead right here in Pittsburgh, where Rockefeller sent in, and there's one place I could never remember the name, out in Colorado, and no, that was Andrew Carnegie here in Homestead, about the unions, okay? And Rockefeller called his buddy up in Colorado, and they murdered like 250 women, children, and men out there.
Or so it's alleged.
Yeah. Well, no, it is not alleged. It did happen, but you never hear about it. You know what I mean?
Hmm. Yeah, okay.
I thought that Ronald Reagan was the worst president we ever had. Well, first I thought it was LBJ.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, I mean...
Well, you know, LBJ with the war in Vietnam was a real screw-up, and he was a fairly corrupt guy. But his war on poverty actually did cut poverty in the United States by half in 4 years. I mean, that's no small accomplishment.
No, that's one thing he did accomplish. You're right about that, Tom.
And he brought literally an entire generation of African-Americans, or a good chunk of it, out of 200 years of slavery and oppression into... many of them into the middle class. I mean, a real significant percentage of African Americans now in the United States are living in the middle class, and they're doing it because of programs LBJ put in place.
LBJ actually accomplished that. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, not the least of them being Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. Without affirmative action programs, neither one of them would have had an opportunity to go to college.
Hey, Tom, yeah. I really wished he would have ran for president. I would have voted for him.
Colin Powell?
Bet,
yeah, know? I think he was the only guy with any morality in the Bush administration, which, of course, is why he was out on his butt, and they threw out his son, too.
By the way, I want to give you a quick throwback.
Yeah.
When Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers,
right.
The guy, the lawyer was right here from Pittsburgh, and it's Poli, P-O-L-I. I remember. They had it on the news. I'm watching it. He went right up and said, you have to go strike. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And then this was around, they were voting at midnight, and after midnight, Reagan fired every one of those. And you know what the biggest disgrace was? And I was so ashamed to belong to union. None of them. Not the Hoffers, not Walter Meany, none of the union leaders came to their defense.
Yeah, what they didn't realize... Because, I mean, first of all, it's hard to defend an illegal strike. But what they didn't realize was that this was a major turning point in the history of labor in the United States. And they didn't get it until long after the fact.
I think it was a deliberate setup. Yeah. I resigned the next day.
Yeah.
Guys are all out of jobs. And how about the Contra affair with Reagan, too? Huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it just goes on and on, Bill. You're absolutely right. It really, really does. And Reagan, I agree with you. He was one of the worst presidents in the history of this country. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hello, Tom. You know, I noticed on Monday I was listening, and I heard you were expecting the Minuteman to be a, like you said, a foaming at the mouth, white xenophobe, and then you were so pleasantly surprised to find he was a polite Hispanic gentleman. And then today I heard...
Well, that's a bit of an oversimplification, but...
Correct. And I think you also said you had a list of code words you were waiting for the Minuteman to use, and you were going to use those code words to expose him on the radio as a repugnant wasp bigot or something like that. And you weren't able to do that because you were so pleasantly surprised to find it was a polite Hispanic gentleman.
Well, not pleasantly surprised, but surprised. And I use the word phrase WASP as a WASP myself. I am a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, so I think that I can
Does that make it correct?
Well, I don't think of it as a slur.
I do.
Why?
For the same reason that blacks don't like to be called the N-word.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, nobody has ever denied me employment because I'm a WASP.
Oh, I have.
Seriously? You think that white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in the United States actually suffer discrimination because they're not Catholic and because they're not African-American or Hispanic or something like that?
Yes. Do you find that hard to believe?
I do, and I've lived as one for over 50 years in this country. I do. I've never experienced that. I mean, I suppose there are probably some parts of this country where you know, being a member of a minority group might be a useful thing, but it hasn't happened to me.
You're not a racist by any chance, are you? Anti-white racist?
No, I really don't consider myself an anti-white racist or an anti-any kind of racist.
Could you be influenced by white guilt?
I suppose it's possible.
I do, too.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
good day.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. You know, the white guilt? I don't know. I'll have to chew on that one. 44 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Remember as you drop the bomb, you're creating your own Vietnam. Since you dodged the traffic then, you cannot comprehend the side effects of war, the scars forevermore.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. White guilt. You know, that's a phrase I haven't heard since, oh, geez, it's probably been 20, 30 years since there was all that blowback by white racists against affirmative action programs. Interesting. Have we just heard from a white supremacist? I'm beginning to think so. I don't know. Interesting. KJ in Camas. Hey, KJ.
Hey, Tom.
Are you a WASP?
Well, actually, I'm not Anglo-Saxon. I'm Scots-Irish. But
that qualifies in America.
Oh, I see. Well, anyway, you know, years ago, during one of the Reagan recessions, I was kind of struggling and having a problem. I just lost a job and was having a hard time finding another one. And the girlfriend I had at the time, you know, instead of being a little sympathetic, she looks at me, gives me this look and says, "Well, come on, you're a white male, use your powers."
Right.
And I thought, well, now my whole life, you know, I'm in my 40s now, and I have never gotten any special privileges because I'm a white male. I've never asked for any, but...
Well, I would suggest, KJ, actually, you and I both have. And we have not by... It's not that somebody came to us and said, here, you can have this, but it's that other people were gone to and said, no, you can't have that. I remember when Louise and I moved to Atlanta from New Hampshire in 1983, and Louise flew down and had a real estate agent showing her around the city. And the woman said, do you want the white-only areas, or are you willing to buy into a mixed area? It'll be a little less expensive. And Louise was like, what?
You know? Nobody's ever asked me that.
Well, you know, my wife was asked that by a real estate. Now, this is 1983 in the city of Atlanta, and yeah, absolutely.
And that was legal?
I don't know if it was legal or not. I frankly don't think so, but it was common. And I've shared that story with other people when I lived in Atlanta, and yeah, that's just, you know, that's the way it was. I don't know if it still is. I haven't lived there in 11 years, 12 years, but yeah, that's, and I would say that the extent to which people in the United States are denied opportunities because they happen to be members of a minority group is the extent to which KJ, you and I have been given opportunities. Doesn't mean that we need to sit around and whip ourselves about it or, you know, get into self-flagellation or guilt. But it is useful, I think, for us to acknowledge the reality that, that inequality is very real. I remember some years ago, 60 Minutes did this special where they had, this must have been about a decade ago, where they had a white guy and a black guy who were friends in college. They were college roommates. Mm-hmm. And they had both graduated from the same school with very similar grades, and they had relatively similar family backgrounds. They were both, you know, middle-class guys, middle-class men with similar educations. And they took them into a couple of different cities and had them try to rent an apartment, try to get a job, and try to buy things in stores, and followed them around with hidden cameras. And the experience was very, very different for these two people. And the old saying, I think it was Bucky Fuller talked about, you know, we stand on giants, on the shoulders of giants. And in a very real way, those of us who have succeeded in America, in life, in, you know, whatever it may be, have done so in some regard because of our own efforts, and in some regard because a lot of people went before us and made the opportunities available to us, but also, and we have to acknowledge, I think, to some extent, because other people were denied those opportunities.
Well, interesting. I mean, from my own experience, let me get into this. Howard Zinn pointed out one of the roots of racism in this country was economic.
I'd say the root of racism is probably psychological. It's the natural human instinct to say, this is my family, this is my community, these are my people. And if there's a visible external marker that says these are my people and that's not my people, it makes it a whole lot easier for people to say, okay, you know, we're gonna help out my people and not help out the other people. I think that's wired into us as a survival instinct that probably goes back 100,000 years. And so at a certain level, you know, not racism, because racism is acting that out, but the instincts that create and drive racism are wired into all of us, I suspect.
And what Howard Zinn was writing about was back when they had white indentured servants,
sure,
who were pretty much treated like black slaves. And the white indentured servants and the black slaves started realizing, you know, we're both getting the shaft from the aristocracy here. Let's gang up on them. And the aristocracy got scared of that, so they came up with this lie to, you know, it's the old divide-and-conquer strategy.
Oh, sure. And you saw that during Reconstruction. Yeah, you saw that during Reconstruction in the 1880s. And a large part of what you were seeing during Reconstruction in the 1880s was the consequence of and the rise of the labor unions and the Wobblies and the progressive movement in the 1880s and 1890s was the fact that in the 1840s and 1850s, when you had the potato famine in Ireland, and by the way, one little bit of history most people don't know, Ireland exported enough wheat to England during the years of the famine to feed everybody in Ireland. But they were forbidden by law to eat it, so they could only eat the potatoes. So in any case, you had all these people, all these immigrants who came to the United States on indentures, most of them, where they would work for 5 or 10 or 15 years in exchange for the passage. And now, by the 1880s and 1890s, it's the second generation. These are the children of indentured servants, but they're no longer indentured. And that was, in my opinion, I mean, just looking at the arc of history, one of the things that really drove that. So it drove the whole the labor and labor rights movement. So, KJ, gotta run. I appreciate the call. Amy in San Diego. Hey, Amy, I think we only have about 20 seconds left here. What's up?
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say, you know, a lot of people think, you know, we don't need affirmative action. You know, it's been 100 years or 150 years since they've been freed. You know, they need to get over it. But I wanted to just say that in my lifetime, I'm 45 years old, I went to kindergarten in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was 1965, and they had a black and a white section of the cafeteria. So how can they think that everything is equal since
Well, that kind of segregation didn't really become illegal until 1967.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember segregation in Lansing, Michigan. And, you know, when I was a kid in the 50s and 60s. And, Amy, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. Yes, you're absolutely right. This is not, you know, slavery ended formally and legally with the Civil War, but it still exists. It still exists in the United States. We just modify our slaves from time to time. Next, coming up, how we lost Iraq with guest Aaron Glantz, the unembedded reporter. What's going on in Iraq? What's his take on this and looking back on this? Also, I want to get into this what's going on with bin Laden, the middle class leaving Iraq, and the FBI busting Mr. Jefferson. We'll carry this
You've
on.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the final results are in. A large study done by the University of California Los Angeles Medical School, UCLA. Smoking pot does not cause cancer. That's pretty amazing. They speculate that THC, the chemical in marijuana, may actually help kill older cells, giving them less of a chance to turn cancerous. They say more research is needed to check the theory, because there are carcinogens in cancer in pot smoke, in anything. I mean, you stand around breathing the smoke from burning leaves, there's carcinogens. So why don't people who smoke pot get cancer, lung cancer and throat cancer, neck cancer, like people who smoke cigarettes do? Maybe there's something in there that's actually it actually heals cancer. Who knows? Anyhow, it's didn't know that for the day. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Aaron Glantz is on the line. He's the author of a book, How America Lost Iraq, the unembedded journalist in Iraq. Aaron's been on our program before. Hey, Aaron, welcome back. Aaron?
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Great to have you here. Aaron, the website, Aaron Glantz, AaronGlantz.com. And, Aaron, what I'd like to do here is just go through some of the your fresh dispatches, if you don't mind. A new Iraqi government, don't believe the hype. George W. Bush out saying here, we have a new government, we have a new prime minister, we have things in Iraq, we've had another turning point here.
Well, he said we've turned the corner, but he also said that we're going to still be there for years, so it's some kind of corner. And this is going to leave Iraqi people scratching their heads, because Bush will take this election that happened and the fact that there's a new Iraqi government as an endorsement of him, where in fact if you were like me and you were in Iraq during one of these campaigns and you saw the advertising and the campaigning that these parties did, they specifically promised, vote for us, don't be violent, vote for us, go to the polls, and we'll get the Americans to leave in 6 months to a year. And this was back in January 2005. Now here we are a year later. We have another election. We have the Iraqi prime minister, again, Maliki, saying we are going to start taking control of different cities in Iraq. And then we have George Bush, just kind of ignoring him. And so I bet, in the days and weeks ahead, as the Iraqi people see what a farce their new government is, just as with the last election, the amount of violence will increase.
Are you seeing, Aaron Glantz, I mean, you've been there, you've been on the ground, you've reported from Iraq, you wrote this book, How America Lost Iraq. Are you seeing the balkanization of Iraq happening? Is this like Lebanon was or Serbia, Bosnia?
What you have to think, Tom, is that all of this is a backdrop against the occupation. It's a backdrop of the lack of basic services. So you have a situation where people in Baghdad have electricity. It goes on for 2 hours, and then it goes off for 2 hours. Then it goes on for 2 hours, and then it goes off for 2 hours. In Basra, people have electricity under 3 hours a day. And it's 130 degrees in Baghdad, and even hotter in Basra during the summer. Imagine trying to sleep without a fan. Imagine there's no water. Imagine that you can't call the police when a crime is committed because the police is all tied up with the foreign occupation that you yourself oppose. So what people do in this kind of environment is they form militias based on their neighborhood, based on their tribe, based on their mosque, because the rest of society has just fallen apart over 3 years of American occupation.
So I guess to sort of restate my question, are we going to see Iraq divided into a Sunni area, a Shia area, and Kurdistan? Or, and if so, is that any kind of thing that could happen with any peacefulness. It seems like it's already going on right now.
Well, there is certainly a lot going on right now. The Association of Muslim Scholars, which is the Sunni clergy group, they announced concern this week that over 1,200 families from the Shiite southern oil city Basra have been forced out of their homes and are now in the Sunni area. There's also ethnic cleansing going on in Kirkuk, which is the northern oil city where the Kurds are trying to muscle out the Arabs that Saddam moved there when he ethnically cleansed the Kurds in the 80s. And all of this right now is just happening on the margins. For example, I've been to northern Iraq many times, and, you know, what really strikes you in northern Iraq is it's very peaceful compared to the rest of the country. And this is in part because of the autonomy that the Kurds have. So in northern Iraq, you have no American patrols that are getting attacked and then American reprisal attacks. Instead, what you have is Kurdish policemen. Now what you're seeing is the Kurds are trying to extend their authority into Kirkuk and grab hold of that oil with the hopes of maybe declaring independence and certainly winning greater autonomy. And I think that the Bush administration has really lost control of the situation. I don't know what they're thinking in general, but I think that the facts on the ground are quickly outstripping any plan that they might have.
If the Bush administration has lost control of the situation, then why are we building a 24-building complex on 104 acres of land in Baghdad that is, we're basically building a city within the green zone within the city for what we call the embassy complex. It's going to be the largest, one of the largest U.S. installations anywhere in the world. Why are we building four major military bases there capable of housing 70, 80,000 troops? And what's the future of those? Are we going to end up, with enclaves?
Well, Tom, I know the future as well as you, but let me paint the scene a little bit of what this looks like. What is the Green Zone? The Green Zone is Saddam Hussein's old presidential palace area in the heart of Baghdad. It's a huge section of the city that borders the Tigris River on one side. It was closed under Saddam Hussein, and now it's closed under the U.S. to regular Iraqis. So it's meet the new boss, same as the old boss. This is what many Iraqis think. In addition to that, whole sections of the city, roads leading to this area, the road that goes on the opposite side of the Tigris to the Green Zone, are closed to Iraqis as a security precaution against attacks on Americans. What this does is it causes terrible traffic jams all throughout Baghdad. Baghdad is a sprawling, hot city spread out with a lot of freeways, kind of like Los Angeles, even has palm trees like L.A., right? And when I wanted to go to a meeting one time with the Minister of Human Rights, he was just about a mile away from where I was staying. But I had to go because I was unembedded. I didn't have any kind of American clearance. I was going around in taxi cabs and cars just like regular Iraqis. I had to drive for 2 hours in a gigantic circle to get to this appointment. And this is what Iraqis are living with every day because of this new base that you're talking about in the center of Baghdad. And all it does is stoke more anger and cause more attacks against American servicemen in Iraq.
Now, Aaron Glantz, author of How America Lost Iraq, his website, Aaron Glantz, GLANTZ.com. One of the first things that Paul Bremer did when he took over there was to rewrite the Iraqi constitution, the Iraqi laws, to create kind of a year zero in Iraq, to turn Iraq into a neocon paradise, a conservative paradise. No more labor unions, no such thing as an illegal alien. Corporations can bring in as much cheap labor from outside the country as they want. In fact, the entire U.S. embassy complex is being built without any Iraqi labor at all, as I understand. What has been the consequence of these conservative economic policies on the Iraqis and the Iraqi people?
Well, unemployment is over 70% in Iraq, but this is primarily due to the war and the security situation and the lack of electricity. I mean, you can imagine running a business where the electricity goes on for 2 hours and then it goes off for 2 hours and then it goes on for 2 hours. You can't run a business in that kind of situation. You can't run a business when there's constant car bombings and American helicopter attacks. You can't do it. Well, I was talking on the phone last night with the head of the Iraqi Oil Workers Union in Basra, and he was saying that What has happened as a result of all the contractors being in his area is it's created kind of a Wild West attitude in the southern port city there. And the amount of oil smuggling, according to the Iraqi government, they have a new report out this week, is more than $1 billion of Iraq's oil every month is just disappearing.
Hmm. Although it's disappearing into the world markets, so it probably is helping keep down the price of oil, which is something that seems to be in our interests.
Well, it's disappearing somewhere, you're right, although they weren't able to pinpoint where. You know, it could be going to Iran. It could be going into the hands of just kind of random smugglers trucking it into Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Or it could be finding its way into an American gas station.
Yeah, amazing. So the future for the United States, basically the Democrats who are saying time to redeploy around the perimeter, is that it?
Well, I think that that's not a bad idea. I think the key thing is to stop patrolling the neighborhoods and get out of people's way.
Yeah, and just let the Iraqis put back together Iraq. They actually ran their country at one time. They know how to do it. Aaron Glantz, A-R-O-N-G-L-A-N-T-Z, the website, the book, How America Lost Iraq. Aaron, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, and I wonder, yes, I wonder, is this the way life's meant to be?
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman radio program. Where being progressive never felt so good. Larry Scott on the line with us. He's the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, one of the nation's premier veterans watchdog organizations, Veterans Administration watchdog organizations. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
Great to have you here. Pat Leahy is suggesting that Secretary Nicholson should consider resigning. Why?
Well, because of the great VA data heist. Senator Leahy spoke with the Associated Press this morning and just basically says there's no reason for this. And, well, the attitude on Capitol Hill right now is the buck has got to stop somewhere. And Patrick Leahy, Senator Leahy, said that the President Bush should take VA Secretary Nicholson into the woodshed. And yeah. Somebody's got to be responsible, and Leahy thinks that VA Secretary Nicholson should consider resigning.
I mean, this comes at the same time. Here's another story from the Associated Press, which may seem unrelated, but I think is part of the whole the same thing. A mock evacuation that was supposed to be part of a two-day statewide hurricane preparedness drill in Louisiana was canceled after a misunderstanding about who had jurisdiction over the FEMA trailer park. FEMA, I mean, these guys, whether it's FEMA or whether it's the Veterans Administration, when George W. Bush puts his political cronies in charge of these government agencies, they start to make the Three Stooges look competent.
And you know you're exactly right, and that's what happened here with Jim Nicholson. Jim Nicholson is a longtime Republican henchman. He is the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. During the first 4 years of the Bush administration, he was the ambassador to the Vatican. The man has absolutely no background in health care. He has no background as a veterans advocate. But now he's running an agency where somebody has allowed 26.5 million names, dates of birth, and social security numbers to walk right out the door and get stolen. And I think someone is going to have to answer for this, and your veterans groups, I feel, are going to be calling for this. They're kind of gathering themselves together now and looking for a united front. It would not surprise me in the next few days to see the big veteran service organization say, you've got to go, Secretary Nicholson.
Hmm. Dan, do you think he will?
It's hard to say. You know, in a case like this, President Bush has always stood by his people. And we've heard before, you know, I will not accept his resignation when generals have called, let's say, for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. So I'm not sure that Nicholson will go. I think if Nicholson has it right, and he's known as a real, real tough cookie when he wants to be. Nicholson, first of all, he's got a credibility problem now. They waited 2 weeks to get this information to the FBI and then another 4 or 5 days before the information became public. But if Nicholson, backtracks and decides to say, okay, here's what we're going to do about this, and we're going to make sure it never happens again, and puts in some really incredible firewall programs and announces that immediately and is very, very forthcoming about it, I think he can save face for himself and also for the agency. But we haven't seen that yet.
You know, how long do you think it'll be, Larry Scott, before Nicholson and Bush figure out a way to blame this on Bill Clinton?
I'm surprised that hasn't come up yet.
I'll bet right now there's some right-wing talk show host going, well, if Clinton had only seen this coming.
You know, it could be that. They'll go back and say, well, if these protections or precautions or firewalls have been put in place 8 or 9 years ago, we wouldn't be looking at this problem today. They can do that if they want. The fact is, we have a problem. That problem is now, and let's solve the problem now. And I really, honestly, on this data heist thing, Tom, I don't think they're being forthcoming. When I was on active duty in the Army, I was an instructor at the Defense Information School. We taught broadcasters and journalists and public relations people, and right after Vietnam, we developed a process called MD2, and what it was maximum disclosure, minimum delay. That means when you have a crisis situation that is going to explode, you get out the most information you can as fast as you can to the press and to the public, because every little bit of information you withhold and every hour you delay, they're going to believe you less and less and less, and that's what we have happening here.
Yeah, plus, when information comes out in dribs and drabs, it extends the news cycle.
Mm-hmm. And it's also wondering, and people will wonder, and veterans are very skeptical people, are they making up the information? Yeah. Now, the information here that was stolen is rather interesting. I don't believe that this is all the information that was stolen, because a name and a date of birth and a Social Security number, there's no data there to analyze. What can you do with that except find out how many Bob Smiths were born on the 4th of July? It's got to have to be tied to disability ratings and disability payments. There had to be more information in that data heist.
Because this guy was an analyst, and he took it home to analyze it.
Right, and there's nothing to analyze if you have a name, a date of birth, and a Social Security number. What can you analyze there? That's a start of a database. Now, if you have addresses, you could be doing geographical analysis. If you have disability ratings and monies paid, you could be doing other types of analyses. And we've been told that in some cases there was a spouse's name in Social Security or children's name in Social Security. The only reason that information would be in there is if the disabled veteran was receiving compensation for the spouse and children as well.
Hmm. Interesting. Or if they were looking for things like genetic disorders, Agent Orange, for example, is it echoing down to the next generation?
That could be in there, especially with the disability situation and also with spina bifida being tied to Agent Orange exposure.
Yeah, there you go. 27 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. Thanks, Larry.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
My old man, he had oil, so I'd never have to toil.
With a knick-knack, bummer-rack, all your money spent.
I'm a wartime president.
He's a wartime president.
And welcome back. Coming up on 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, Louisiana canceled a mock hurricane evacuation because FEMA couldn't figure out where they put their trailers. 2-day statewide drill that began Tuesday was aimed at avoiding the chaos that followed last year's deadly Hurricane Katrina. It looks like they replicated it. Oh, my. The Baker evacuation was canceled because of an apparent communications breakdown, said Joanne Moreau, director of the East Baton Rouge Parish Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness. We were unable to get any information from the state or federal government on what policies or procedures were for evacuating those sites, whose jurisdiction it was. We're very disappointed we didn't get to work with the people who live on the trailer site. Remarkable, as one of the folks in the chat room said. Sometimes these guys make the Three Stooges look efficient. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, and Rebecca in Edmonds, Washington on the line. Hey, Rebecca, what's on your mind?
Hi there. Well, just to get back to the In the Shadows frame that you and Jeffrey Feldman were talking about earlier.
Yes.
This is so hypocritical.
Just if I may interrupt you, Rebecca, just for our listeners who might have tuned in since then, just I'll recap it very, very quickly.
Yes.
The frame that Jeffrey Feldman of Frame Shop is Open was talking about was he did a keyword search and discovered that right after 9/11, George W. Bush started referring to terrorists as, quote, in the shadows, end quote,
mm-hmm.
and that a week or so ago, he and Dick Cheney started referring to Hispanics as being in the shadows. I'm sorry, say that again, Alex? As being in the shadows as well.
Right.
So,
I was going to mention that. Anyway, it's just so hypocritical, and I started listing just a few of the many, many examples of the Bush administration being in the shadows, and we need to turn that back on them because just Karl Rove alone, all those dirty tricks to win elections for Bush in Texas, phone jamming the New Hampshire 2002 election when they stole the Senate seat from Jeanne Shaheen and gave it to Sununu, the dirty tricks, of course, in South Carolina against McCain, in Georgia against Max Cleland. And then you go to Dick Cheney from his undisclosed dislocations, that's a Freudian slip, his undisclosed locations. And the Traitorgate leaking of Valerie Plame's name now being linked to Dick Cheney in the shadows, hiding behind his aides in the White House and his pals in the media. And today, or last night, I read that the FCC rejects Ed Markey's request that the FCC investigate the illegal selling or giving of private information by telecoms to the U.S. government. They say they cannot investigate because these are classified.
Right.
Now, that's in the shadows.
Which is what happened to the Justice Department 2 weeks ago when the FBI tried to investigate, and they were told that they couldn't investigate it. And, by the way, another one that lest we forget, Cheney was given two jobs when he became vice president by Bush.
Yes.
One was to be the head of the counterterrorism task force, which never met until September of 2001. And the second was to be the head of the energy task force, put together an energy policy for the
mm-hmm.
United States,
mm-hmm.
which he did very aggressively. Mm-hmm. We know that in March and April, they were actually dividing up the country of Iraq and its oil fields and deciding which countries they were going to sell it to. But he went all the way to the Supreme Court to keep in the shadows, to keep hidden and secret the names of the people who participated in that meeting and the companies they represented.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's the most Orwellian thing I can think of, or the most hypocritical thing, because there has never been an administration more in the shadows.
Yeah.
And yet they're implying that our immigrants are in the shadows.
This is part of why I suggested to Jeffrey Feldman that perhaps this was unconscious, that they were simply projecting their
right.
own.
Right. That was interesting.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. And I mentioned to you online or by email that there is a woman, Rosalinda Guillen, who is a leader against the Minutemen on the northern border.
We're trying to book her.
Okay, great.
Because
Al Garza, he's very smooth and very persuasive, but you have to be very careful because, you know, they're really tricky. So just, you know, attention, be careful.
Yeah, no, I will. And my, you know, as I said before, I think that this is the kind of organization that draws the, I was going to say the worst of society, but really it's the most fearful of society.
Well, what I thought of is maybe doing the right thing for the wrong reason because going and protesting the large corporations that are hiring illegals is the right thing to do, but they have a different reason for doing it.
Yeah, well,
It does need to be done.
Yeah, and the follow-up question that, you know, looking back on that interview that I should have asked was, well, which corporations, you know?
Yes.
Let us help publicize this or something, because, you know, maybe this was some little, I don't know. We have to do a little more research on it, and I look forward to getting on the guest that you recommended. Rebecca, thank you for the call. Great
thank
to hear
you.
From
Bye-bye.
You. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number from the West Coast to the East Coast in lightning speed, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. You talked about fear in George Bush. The last caller just kind of dovetailed exactly what I was going to try to get to, if I may. I think you're right. I think he may have a personal problem with fear, and I think he certainly leads by fear. But I've always believed it's more than that, Tom, in my humble opinion. I believe he's so extremely competitive by nature, and so is their party, that they don't subscribe to the old saying, it's not who wins or loses, it's how you play the game.
They
well,
don't subscribe to that theory.
I would agree with the last half of what you said. I don't think, however, that George W. Bush is competitive because he's never entered into an honest competition. Single business in his life was handed to him on a silver platter, and he screwed them all up.
But that doesn't mean he's not competitive by nature, though. I'm not trying to differ with you. I would
feel free.
I really believe that. I've always felt that about, and it mirrors the party.
Yeah, they're not interested in competition either. They're interested in winning, and there's a difference between competition and simply saying, I'm going to win.
Meaning?
Competition implies that there is some evenness, that there are rules that you play by.
Oh, they don't believe in that.
That's right, and so I would say they don't believe in competition. They really believe in the rights of aristocracy. And I'm convinced that Bush does, that he was born with a silver spoon in, you know, the old joke that Ann Richards made. He was born with silver, about his father. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth and thought he'd, he was born on third base and thought he'd hit a triple.
When you understand, and I'm not trying to be personal about the president, I'm really not, because hell, I made more mistakes than he got a hair in his head. But it's their nature; they're a different breed of cat. They just don't get it. I think he mirrors the whole party. You don't believe he's the first one that's acted like this. He may be next to the worst. But he's not the first president of the Republican Party that's acted like this.
No, but I would say that he's probably only the second president of the United States, at least in the 20th and 21st centuries, at least in the last 100 years, who has suffered from serious psychopathologies that are affecting his ability to be president. The other being Richard Nixon, who was clinically paranoid as well. And
that also, yeah, and sorry, I didn't mean to, I'll let you go here. That also transforms, I think, into an America with a culture of go along, get along. We can't accomplish anything. We can't seem to get through it.
Yeah, no, we must, this is one of the goals of leadership is to provide a national role model, and we really do need to be getting back to, you know, what is America all about? What are our goals? What are our ideals? How do they differ from those of traditional aristocracies and kingdoms? And why do we say, you know, we're not about aristocracy and kingdom? Of course, the conservatives are about it, and so they're constantly trying to reinvent it. Jay in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Jay.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but yeah. I'll get better. What's up?
Okay. I heard about the loss of the data from the VA, and it raised a question that's bothered me for some time. Why should I'm a veteran, but that it wouldn't matter anyway. Why should I, as a consumer, care if some bank issues a credit card to somebody in my name and they make bad loans? Why should I care? Why should I be in the least bit responsible? Why do we make such a big deal of identity theft when the only ones who really should be responsible for this are the banks and the idiots who lend the money without getting proper ID?
If it was just the banks and the credit card companies, I would agree with you. But, you know, there are so many ways that people can steal your identity and then go out and exploit not just companies and corporations, but even other people as well. It's more than just that. I do agree with you, though, that the rules have been skewed considerably to the benefit of the credit card companies and banks and whatnot, and to the detriment of we the people, certainly, hugely.
If I put on a George Bush mask and I go out and I declare war on Romania or something, and the idiots follow me, why should I be responsible?
Well,
I think this is what it amounts to. Somebody's making bad loans without bothering to get the proper identification of somebody, that should be their problem, their hassle.
But what if they do check the identification and it comes back that it is you and it isn't you? I mean, really well done identity theft is successful despite attempts to thwart it.
But I still don't see why I should be responsible if some clever person, like I had an episode years ago, somebody wrote a check to me, forged my name, and cashed it. And then the bank took the money out of my account. I said, hey, wait a minute. I didn't do that. I wasn't even in town. And they had to give me my money back. And it seems like all these laws are there just to protect the financial institutions.
Well,
and
that's a good point. That's a good point. And it gets back to the whole thing with the bankruptcy bill that we just recently saw passed, where half of all bankruptcies in the United States are the result of people being wiped out by medical bills. A third of all bankruptcies in the United States are the result of mostly women getting divorced and ending up without the earnings power, but with the bills, or at least half the bills. and you add a half and a third together, and you're left with what? A sixth of bankruptcies are for some other reason? And out of that sixth of bankruptcies that are for some other reason, less than 1% of them actually have anything to do with fraud, and most of those people involved with fraud end up being prosecuted. So there was no need for bankruptcy reform other than to rip us off, to make it harder for people to declare bankruptcy and start over again, which defies the traditional American values of, hey, take a risk out there. You know, get out there, be an entrepreneur, take a risk. And, you know, we're going to look out for those people who get wiped out by things like getting cancer and they can't pay the bills. But in any case, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we, the people who can't ignore them. We shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Alberto Capote Gonzalez won't confirm that the federal government collected the phone records of millions of Americans, blogs Judd over at thinkprogress.org. As reported in the May 11th USA Today, but yesterday he said it was legal, perfectly legal. But this was published in the Washington Post, of all places. They quoted Gonzalez talking about the Smith versus Maryland Supreme Court ruling. Now, in Smith versus Maryland in 1979, the Supreme Court ruled that it is legal for the FBI or the CIA, not the CIA, for the FBI, for the government to collect telephone records and examine those records. The only problem is that in 1978, there was a law put into place that became law the following year, the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act, Surveillance Act, excuse me. The law allows this kind of domestic surveillance only under two circumstances. One, the government obtains a warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or two, the government obtains a certification from the Attorney General that the program is legal under FISA. Neither action was taken by Gonzalez. And then in 1986, perhaps even more germane, there was the Stored Communications Act of 1986. That law makes it illegal for communication companies to hand over phone records without a court order to the government, to any government agency. There are a few exceptions, but none of them apply in this instance. This law was passed in response to the Smith versus Maryland ruling, which Washington Post today reported on without once mentioning the Stored Communications Act. In other words, the Washington Post acted today as a mouthpiece for Alberto Gonzalez and the Bush administration, essentially promoting and promulgating their claim that what they did was legal when, in fact, it's not legal. And the Washington Post never called them on it. Shame on you, Washington Post. Rick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Greetings.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
I was calling about Alberto Gonzalez, our attorney general, and how he's coming up with these rulings against spying on citizens. And the other one kind of skips my mind right now, but he's coming up with stuff that's un-American. The Torture Act. I'm a veteran. We went to school on being captured, and we don't approve of torture, but yet he can come up with it's legal to torture under certain circumstances to protect the people.
Right.
I just don't understand how he does that.
He doesn't do it legally. The problem is that the Democrats don't control the House or the Senate, and the Republicans are running the House and the Senate in ways that it has, to the best of my knowledge, never been run before. It's been run like a mafia operation. And
yeah, exactly.
Any voice of dissent gets quelched.
Yeah, they're shields for the president, and they're not doing their job protecting the rights of the American citizen or, you know, are what we stand for worldwide.
Yeah, and so the solution, very simply, Rick, is that you and I and all of our listeners need to engage politically. And that doesn't just mean getting ready to vote in November. That means participating in the political process right now, supporting good candidates, send them $10, show up to canvas, go door to door, show up at the party meetings, show up at conferences, go to democracyforamerica.org and sign up, you know, show up at a local meeting, get involved.
That's exactly. I'm almost 60, and all the young people that don't vote, I talk to them all the time about doing their civic responsibility. If they're not in the military, they should at least vote.
Yeah, at the very least.
Government.
Yeah, and I'd take it a step beyond that. I should say, I would say they should at least show up, you know, engage themselves in politics. And it's not just young people, it's all of us. Although young people are particularly hard hit by this because with this whole No Child Left Behind and teaching to the test and everything else. Well, it's not just that. I mean, basically it goes back to the Reagan administration and the David, what was his name? David Horowitz, I think his name is. The guy who's running around going, there's communists in the schools. And all the teachers got all paranoid about teaching American history and civics because they were being attacked by right-wingers. And we don't teach that stuff in school anymore, ever since the Reagan administration. Chris in Seattle. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, how are you? This is probably going to sound like a conspiracy nut, but I'm not really a conspiracy nut. But I did, before the last presidential election, when the Republicans' polls were so low, and I had friends all telling me how, oh, we're going to take back the White House. I said, you know what, I wish we would, but I don't think so, because this is not an administration who looks like they're worried about an election. Yeah. And I think that the way they're going to take this next election is by releasing the bird flu on us just before the election. Then nobody goes to the polls.
Or at least causing us to think that the bird flu is out.
Yeah, exactly. Already we're hearing about the human-human contact in Indonesia where they can't find any birds. You know, well, if you've got your first supposed contact now of human-to-human, you spread that out 6 months. Right around the election.
The problem with that, Chris, is that the folks in Indonesia who are doing this, the World Health Organization, they're not only nonpartisan, they're not even part of the U.S. government. This is the United Nations.
Oh, I'm not saying that they're doing it, but I just think that the this administration is going to take it, or like I said, if they don't actually expose people to it, put it out there where, you know, maybe a few people get it and it starts to spread, and then they've got to declare martial law just before the election where nobody can go out and vote.
Yeah, interesting theory, Chris. It's spooky. You know, what it causes me to think, and thank you for the call, what it causes me to think of is when the Republicans wanted to get the Patriot Act passed, and the only two men in the Senate standing between them and getting this thing passed were the head of the Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy, Senator Pat Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, and Tom Daschle, who was the head of the Senate at the time, because the Democrats had taken the Senate. And those are the only two guys who got anthrax in the mail. And all of a sudden, they couldn't be in their offices, and the Patriot Act got passed. Surprise, surprise. Anyhow, tomorrow, Randy Hall, we're going to debate RU 486 and David Corton, his new book, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. That and more in your calls. Remember, my friends, democracy.